From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the past 48 hours when the White House made a move to buy up the entire world's supply of a drug that can treat COVID-19. The Department of Health and Human Services purchased the entire stock of remdesivir for the month of July and 90% of remdesivir supply that will be available in August and September. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar called it an amazing deal designed to make sure any American who needs remdesivir can get it this summer. Meanwhile, experts around the world are fuming that the United States will suck up the entire supply of the first authorized therapeutic for COVID. So does it work? And what do we know about remdesivir? Some of the most significant research has been done here at Rochester, at the University of Rochester Medical Center and Rochester Regional Health. Local researchers have also been conducting trials for a coronavirus vaccine, and vaccine development has been moving at an unprecedented speed around the world. Rochester, one of four sites in the U.S. that is conducting early-stage studies. Our guests this hour are two of the researchers who we've been talking to in the last several months about remdesivir vaccines and more, and we welcome them back to the program and are grateful for the expertise of Dr. Ann Falsey, an infectious disease specialist with Rochester Regional Health, a professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of Rochester Medical Center, and co-director of the URMC Vaccine Trials and Evaluation Unit. Dr. Falsey, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And Dr. Angela Branch, assistant professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of Rochester Medical Center and co-director of the URMC Vaccine Trials and Evaluation Unit. Dr. Branch, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Listeners, this is a chance. We are going to talk remdesivir. We'll talk vaccines. And we'll talk about what we do know and don't know and what questions are in the process of being answered. If you've got questions this hour, you can email the program, connections@wxxi.org. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, again, connections@wxxi.org. Dr. Falsey, I'll start with you, and I'll ask both of you. Remdesivir is, it's a drug that, you know, we've heard a lot about in the last several months, and I know there were different studies going on in different sort of doses or dose maybe being the wrong word, sample sizes, you know, different sort of layers of trials here. What do we know? What happened here? And can you both take us through it? I'll start with Dr. Falsey.
Okay. So you're right. Early on, before what we call a placebo control trial that was blinded, so the investigators and the patients didn't know what they were getting, that's the highest quality evidence to see whether a drug is really effective. Before that, it was used what we call compassionate use. Gilead had sponsored some different trials where everybody got the drug, just different lengths of treatment, 5 days versus 10 days. And what we know from the placebo-controlled trial, which was a very large trial of over 1,000 people, is that there was clear benefit to receiving remdesivir. It's not a magic bullet, and you know we can definitely improve, but there was an improvement in the time to recovery, and that was quite significant.
Okay. Dr. Branch, you want to characterize what you've seen in this trial?
I would agree with what Dr. Falsey said. I think that there's several trials now have shown that remdesivir is beneficial, and one early one did not. I think that the definitive trial is the one recently published in the New England Journal of Medicine that we were forced to be part. It's a trial that occurred all across the world and enrolled within 6 to 8 weeks patients of varying different severities. We certainly saw that there was a length of illness and a severity of illness sort of sweet spot where the treatment with remdesivir was the most effective. We were sort of seeing that in folks who were not necessarily as ill, who had mild illnesses, but still were being observed in the hospital, that remdesivir didn't necessarily prove to be very beneficial. And then there was a group of subjects who were very, very severely ill, had been ill for maybe several weeks and infected for several weeks. And in that group, again, the benefit of remdesivir wasn't as strong. So there's certainly, you know, as Anne said, benefit. It isn't a magic bullet, and there's certainly sort of a cohort of subjects, a group of subjects in that moderate sort of category, sick enough to be in the hospital, sick enough for oxygen, very feverish, sort of on the cusp of maybe getting worse. In that group of subjects that we saw the greatest benefit of remdesivir, which is sort of what you would expect an antiviral. And then the last thing that Dr. Falzi mentioned that I wanted to point out is that we've been sort of been data that shows that that 10 days might be the right course for some for a bit more ill, but for so a 5-day course does seem to be beneficial.
So let me just jump in and follow that point with Dr. Falzi. So Dr. Falzi, if there is something out there, if there is a drug that is, as you said, this is not a magic bullet. If there is something close to that, in other words, a drug that whatever stage of sickness you have COVID-19, this drug is going to arrest that or maybe even reverse it. It could prevent death. If that exists, remdesivir is not necessarily it. Is that fair, Dr. Falzi?
It's beneficial, and you know there probably is a mortality benefit if you are ill, but not necessarily in respiratory failure. The publication in the New England Journal, it's important to say, was an interim analysis, a preliminary analysis, and the mortality benefit didn't quite reach statistical significance at 14 days, but in certain subgroups, which were not the primary analysis, there was a benefit. So I think there is a benefit. It's not like taking penicillin for a bacterial infection, but it's a good drug, but we need to do better.
Yeah, and Dr. Falzi, I think this is where I've been amazed at the speed of what's been happening in the medical and research community this year. I mean, the pandemic is still half a year old, and it's really in this country 3 coming up on 4 months old, and yet now we've got pretty good information about remdesivir. How do you, though, Dr. Falzi, take what you've learned and make sure that the medical community has good information on how to use it? You know, for example, if a patient is in a much later or worse stage of COVID versus a patient that's maybe just recently hospitalized, how much dose? I mean, how effectively do you think that that information is going to get to medical specialists?
You know, I think that it's so much on everybody's mind. It's so important that almost every hospital has a committee. It's usually the pharmacy committee of physicians that are made up of a variety of specialists, usually include an infectious disease person, who is really up on all the literature and trying to decide how best to utilize these new drugs, particularly if it becomes in short supply. And then you have to make decisions on which group of patients will benefit, what dose, for how long, so that you can do the best, the most good for the most people.
Okay, and Dr. Branch and Dr. Falzi, I'm curious to know what questions you still have. Dr. Branch, what questions do you still have about remdesivir?
that's a good question. So I think that we participated in a large clinical trial, but we haven't ourselves been able to see some of the subgroup analyses. I'm really interested in how remdesivir performed across various different ages, even maybe race and ethnicity. I'm interested in learning a little bit more about any sort of mild side effects that we saw, like if there were particular targets, particular populations or groups of people where it was more likely than not. I'm interested in understanding about that really severe group of people who had respiratory failure and were in the ICU and on ventilators. I'd like to learn a little bit more about how remdesivir performed in that group. And I think the data looking at 5 versus 10 days is really interesting. It sort of makes you wonder if 5 days is sufficient for everyone, if you really need to do a 10-day course. Because certainly if you could just do a 5-day course, then you increase the number of patients that you can treat with a relatively limited supply of drug.
Okay. Dr. Falzi, what questions do you still have?
Oh my goodness, where to start? There's so many questions. I think that it starts with the question of we don't completely understand the pathogenesis of COVID. Clearly the virus is part of the problem, but an overactive immune system is also part of the problem, and every patient may not be exactly the same. And so we also want to know, maybe the best treatment is not only an antiviral like remdesivir, but adding in something to calm down the immune system. So, whether combination therapy, whether you can improve the activity of the antiviral by using something that targets a different part of the life cycle of the virus. We could go on and on. There's still so much to learn.
Is it the best that we know of right now? I mean, in other words, Dr. Falzi, is there anything else out there that is showing more promise than remdesivir?
Not as a specific antiviral. Mm-hmm. That there's a number of things that are in preclinical development, early stage clinical development, and in fact, Dr. Branch and I are part of the NIH consortium. It's actually an international group of investigators to decide what the next step will be. We just completed, again, here at the university, a trial of remdesivir with or without a drug called baricitinib. And baricitinib is something that calms down the immune system. It's been FDA approved for many years for rheumatoid arthritis. So that is just wrapping up. We won't know the results of that, but we, in fact, have a call tonight to discuss with this group of investigators what should the next thing be that is studied. Generally, when you have a drug that's effective, it's got to be in combination with remdesivir. I think at this point, nobody would feel ethically comfortable just not giving the remdesivir if you could give it to a patient who's ill.
Yeah, and this is where I'm going to get myself in trouble, Dr. Falzi, with baricitinib. When you say that baricitinib can calm down the immune system, my research and reading on COVID has me wondering, is that possibly a benefit given the potential overreaction of an immune system to some COVID-19 patients, whether it's, I guess, a cytokine storm or some other reaction that the body may have? Is baricitinib involved in trying to sort of calm that possible reaction?
Oh, that's exactly what it's doing. It's an interesting drug that it's both something that tampers down the immune system, and it potentially has some antiviral effects. So it's different than some of the other treatments you may be reading about. But that was the primary goal in using this particular medication, was the ability to sort of calm down that overactive immune system.
Okay. And I know both of you are very, very interested in making sure that your work remains apolitical, and for good reason. So this next question is not meant to be a political question, just looking at, I don't know what is typical. So when Alex Azar, Secretary of Health and Human Services, announces this week that the United States is purchasing all of the stock of remdesivir for the month of July, 90% of the drug supply that would be available in August and September, and there are some complaints around the world of saying, hey, if this is the first, certified therapy for COVID-19, you ought to spread it out a little bit here. I don't know if this is common. Dr. Branch, does that strike you as something that's outside of the work you're doing? It's not something for you to comment on? Did that look inappropriate? Does that look totally common? I don't know.
I think it's a bold move. I think we have the third highest number of cases in the world, I believe, or maybe even the second. Certainly we have a high incidence in the United States and cases are surging. So I would understand why, the HHS would sort of make this bold move to try to secure a drug that we know is beneficial. Obviously, Ann and I are both physicians and, we take that oath very seriously. And we are thinking about this as a global pandemic and not necessarily a local or national one. And I think what happens in the rest of the world will affect the United States as well. So I do sort of understand why the government may have made that move in light of the fact that cases are surging so dramatically here in the United States. But I think that
That it's just really a call to arms, not just to Gilead, but to other companies to really be developing treatments, because we're not going to be able to keep up with the demand just based on one single drug being produced by one company. And so I think as scientists and as investigators, it makes me just feel that much more urgent in continuing to conduct these kinds of trials and find new therapies so that the world supply isn't so limited.
Well, and on that subject, Dr. Branch, trying to keep up with demand here, I was reading the writing of an American writer who's now living in Paris, who says that it is bizarre to him to be in France, to be in Europe, to see the European response, which he described as, you know, there's always political or policy debate, but he said it did not become a cultural war. And, you know, France obviously hit hard, Spain, we know Italy, but they have really bent the numbers very, very far back down. And the way he writes about it this morning, he says, I'm sitting in a French cafe, life is mostly pretty normal. You know, the pace of life feels like a typical summer day in France, and I'm reading of the case numbers in the United States, and it is, he said, frankly, bizarre to see what's happening in the United States, given how many months there has been to work on this problem, and yet to see the case numbers where they are. Is it surprising you? I mean, we talked on television almost 3 months ago, and I don't know if anybody was predicting in July to see the case numbers where we were, given what we had hoped to do collectively as a country to bend that curve, to start to play offense against it, to test more, to trace more. Is it surprising to you, Dr. Branch?
I don't know that it's surprising. I think that it really goes back to the fact that we are a very heterogeneous country. We're really different than France and Germany and other countries in Europe in that we have states, and each state have different local laws and practices that they instituted in response to the pandemic. I think we did flatten the curve or lower the curve because initially in the first couple of months the cases were really on the East Coast and on the West Coast. And so, you know, I think one of the things that Dr. Fauci and some of the other leaders coming out of Washington have been saying is that this isn't the second wave. This is still the first wave. The wave is just moving, making its way across the country. And so it's flattened here on the East Coast, but it's sort of making its way to the West and the South. And I think that where the cases were highest, where there were hot spots and surges on the East Coast and the West Coast, we've been really aggressive in our social distancing practices and sort of the response from government. And I think places where there were few cases, maybe in those first initial months, it wasn't as aggressive a response, and this sort of reflects that. But, you know, in a country as large as ours is and as heterogeneous as ours is, it's really hard to enforce one-size-fit-all kind of process, especially when we were still really understanding this pandemic. And I think that the coming to the realization that it was a real thing, that it was going to stick around for longer than just a few months, that it wasn't going to go away when the weather got warm or as some were postulating, and that that it was going to affect every facet of American life and every single family. And I think sort of coming to that realization as a nation just took us a little while.
Hmm. Dr. Falsey, do the numbers in this country surprise you?
Say surprise. I'm dismayed. I'm not sure it really had to be this way. If we had a bit more of a uniform approach, but I think Dr. Branch brings up an excellent, you know, thought that, you know, it is a collection of states. You know, America was founded on the independent spirit. I think particularly the thing I find discouraging is that there seems to be a distrust of science in this country among some segments of the population, and that can be very hard to overcome if you don't believe what you're hearing from the experts. I think it's very difficult to then modify people's behavior.
So what do you make of the federal government's move to buy up as much of remdesivir as they can, Dr. Falsey?
Well, you know, I think that every government tends to operate in their own self-interest. I don't know that the United States is unique in that regard. And as Dr. Branch pointed out, we have a lot of cases. I would like to see us be a good global citizen and that the allocation should be proportionate to the disease that each country is experiencing. It's interesting that on one of these phone calls early on, when it was told to us, the investigators, that this was looking very good, this study was an international study. Many partners in Europe and in Asia, and it was brought up on the call that they were worried that they would help participate and show that this drug was effective, and yet they were a little concerned they might get shut out of having access. I don't want to get into the politics of things. I'm a physician and a scientist, but, you know, I think one would like us to be good global citizens.
All right, fair enough. Dr. Ann Falsey, Dr. Angela Branch joining us, talking about the work that was done here to study remdesivir and essentially updating the public now on what we do and don't know about remdesivir, how it fits as a therapy for COVID-19, and what it means in case someone in our sphere of life needs it. And the answer is it's not a cure-all, but it certainly has shown to be effective in certain cases. And that's more than we can say for a lot of other therapies. There's still a lot of hope for other things that are out there, and perhaps we'll see as that continues. But Drs. Falsey and Branch joining us to talk about not only remdesivir, but also a vaccine trial and what we expect when it comes to vaccines. So let me ask both of you. Dr. Branch, I'll start with you. We're now in July. In March and in April, there was a lot of talk about the fastest possible timeline for a vaccine. You cautioned us to be perhaps optimistic because the world's community's attention is on this challenge. But also, historically, vaccines have come with a lot of starts and stops and successes and failures. And it doesn't really usually happen in 6 to 9 months to 12 months, even 18 months. It's possible. What do we know now? What are you seeing now? And where is a realistic optimism in July?
I feel more optimistic in July than I did when I first talked to you in April, because I'd never seen this or read about this being done this quickly, a brand new vaccine for a pathogen we've never had a vaccine against in 12 to 18 months. That seemed unthinkable. But we are, in fact, moving into phase 3 trials starting this summer of candidate vaccines, which in phase 1 and phase 2, where you sort of test how safe it is and whether or not it produces an immune response that is potentially protective. In those first two phases, there's several candidates that are looking very promising, and we're moving at least 3, possibly more, into phase 3 trials over the next 3 to 4 months. The phase 3 trials are sort of the definitive trial that you would do before you moved on to FDA licensure. So assuming that any one of these or more than one of these, which is the hope, performs well in phase 3, then it's certainly possible to get to that point of licensure by the end of the year.
Wow. Dr. Falsey, has your view shifted similarly?
Yeah, I would agree. I've been in vaccine research for, going on 30 years, and what's going on now is fairly mind-blowing, that, Operation Warp Speed, even though it has a cheesy name, is effective at the government is partnering with industry to bring forth very rapidly vaccine candidates. And importantly, because, I again would like to stress that the steps are not being skipped. We are still doing phase 1 safety trials that then are expanded, but they're moving rapidly because a lot of bureaucratic red tape is being eliminated. But the other thing they're doing is the manufacturers are scaling up at no risk. So let's say that one of these trials that we start in August here, by the end of the year, it's been shown to be effective. What you would hope is the FDA would very rapidly approve, and all the while the manufacturers are manufacturing the vaccine, not knowing that it's effective, but just in case it is, they're ready to go, and that's pretty amazing.
Well, and so, listeners, I know you got questions. I got an email from a listener named Matt who said, you know, at some point, can you have them clarify? We hear phase one, phase two, phase three. Just make sure we understand again, because we're not participating in medical research, what those phases mean, how long they typically take. We will do that. We're also going to hear from one of the 40 local people participating in the vaccine trial. And we've got more of your questions and comments as well. So let's take our only break of the hour. And when we come back with Drs. Ann Falsey and Angela Branch, from the URMC Vaccine Trials and Evaluation Unit, we're going to talk about the path to a vaccine. And Dr. Branch has given us, well, really both doctors, but Dr. Branch was kind of the voice of be careful with what you hope for in April. And to hear her say now in July that we, you know, we're at least moving on a track that could put us within a vaccine on that that optimistic timeline. Well, that puts a little bit of a bounce in my step, but we will take more of your questions as well, listeners, as we talk vaccines next. Coming up in our second hour, there's a lot of art these days about identity. But we get a chance to welcome an author who can write about identity, a sense of place, what it means to be an American, what it means to be Indian, Asian, a woman of color, all of these themes in the kind of complexity that might be rare in art these days. Her book is called This Is One Way to Dance. We welcome Sejal Shah next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I want to bring in Becky Timmons, one of 40 local people participating in the vaccine trial. Becky's on the line with us now. Becky, welcome. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, very good. And I heard you saw one of these other guests on the line with us just today, Becky.
I did. I saw Dr. Falsey this morning.
Long time no talk, Dr. Falsey says. Before we get Becky's experience then, Dr. Falsey, since she just saw you this morning, why don't you tell us what the 40 local people who are participating in the vaccine trial here, what that process is like and what you're aiming to do?
Okay. So this is the Pfizer RNA vaccine, and this is a phase one vaccine study. To answer that question, this is when you bring in very small numbers of healthy people so that you can focus on the safety and the immunogenicity. Does it produce the right kind of immune response that you're looking for?
Phase one, though, typically, again, smaller numbers, you said, so...
Right. So this is, we bring in groups of 3 to 5 each day. We're working with 4 other institutions, NYU, Maryland, and Cincinnati, and there is continual safety monitoring. Each of the participants fills out diary cards. We see them frequently. We do frequent blood testing just to make sure as we go forward there's no safety signals that would preclude moving ahead.
Okay, and phase two then would be how many? Like what would be the process
there?
So
phase two, you usually move from, phase one is usually roughly 50 to 100 people. Phase two, you expand into 1 to 2,000, making sure, you know, in phase one, you select the proper dose. It's the right balance between having some side effects versus the best immune response. And then you select the right candidate to move into phase two, and that's generally, you know, 1 to 2,000, where you, again, get more information on safety and immunogenicity before you start moving into an efficacy trial, which is phase three, and that's generally, you know, something on the order of 10 to 30,000 people.
What phase does this thing end up in my arm?
Well, that's after phase three. Okay. If the FDA looks at the data and it's shown to be safe and effective at preventing the disease, the FDA then goes through a process to approve it, FDA approved, and then it becomes available to the public.
So Becky Timmons, how did you hear about this?
I think that I heard about it on Facebook. I think it was through one of the local news stations, had a post on Facebook about it.
Okay, and why did you decide you wanted to be a part of it?
I think multiple reasons. I think the biggest reason was that when all of this started, when the disease kind of was identified and we all kind of locked down, and I think everybody felt really helpless. It's not something, you know, a lot of big things happen and you can crowdfund or you can pitch in and help fix something. This didn't feel like that. Everybody, I think, felt kind of helpless and didn't know what to do. We can all wear our masks and stuff, but this felt like an opportunity to actually do something and help and be part of it.
Well, I admire that very, very deeply. I think that's great. What did you have to consider about your own health before you decided, yes, I will be part of this one?
I read through they provide a contract and kind of explain everything that's going to happen. I did a lot of background research on how these types of vaccines work because it's something new. But in general, I'm a healthy person, so I wasn't super concerned about the side effects or anything.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I understand that. Certainly, I admire the idea of, you know there's a risk, but better me than some other people in society, part of this trial.
Exactly.
So what has the trial entailed for you? When did it start?
I think a little over a month ago. I think I've been in 6 times at this point. So I did some pre-screening appointments. I had the first vaccine 3 weeks ago, came in for some follow-up appointments, and then this morning I went back in for the second dose of the vaccine.
So 3 weeks ago you get the first dose. Is it surreal when that's happening, knowing that the whole world is talking about the need for a vaccine and the way the world will change when an effective vaccine is finally widely available? Is there something surreal about being part of this?
Maybe a little bit. It was definitely, the response was surreal when I posted that I was being part of it. And there was an initial interview done a couple of weeks ago, and I think I was surprised by the response to that. But yeah, it does feel a little bit surreal.
Surprised in what way?
I don't know. I think people had a lot of questions about it. I think I was shocked that I kept getting a lot of thank yous. For some reason, I didn't feel like I was deserving of that, I guess. I just really wanted to help.
Okay. So, no, I think that's very interesting, but I will echo that. I'm grateful to you and anybody who is doing this work. I absolutely am.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. Dr. Branch, does that make sense to you? I mean, I think we should be saluting this kind of work.
Oh yeah. No, absolutely. We're so thankful for you and for everyone who comes forward and is willing to participate in this kind of work. I mean, even when we were doing the remdesivir trial and having to talk to family members of people who were sick and on the ventilator in the ICU, and they were just like, sure, I would do anything if it'll help him and if it'll help others. And even some of these patients, once they come off the vent, they tell you the same thing. Like, we don't know if they got drug or not, but they say, you know, we would have done it anyways just to be able to help. And I just think that that's heroic. So thank you. And thank you to all the vaccine and treatment participants over the last couple of months. It's been amazing.
And Becky, how are you feeling? Any effects from that first dose 3 weeks ago? How's it going?
No, the first dose felt like a flu shot. I get a flu shot every year. My arms usually sore the next day. So it was that same feeling. Today it's only been about 2 hours. So I feel completely fine right now, but I expect that my arm will probably be sore again tomorrow.
Okay. And as much as you've gotten the thank yous, has anybody in your close circle of friends and family said that they were nervous about you doing this?
Yes, I think so. My very close family is very supportive. My parents, my sister, they were both very interested in what I was doing, and they've been extremely supportive. But I've certainly got some friends who have questioned it, and I've sent them links to the proper information.
Okay. Becky, I never do this unless there's a really good reason, but I am curious to know, how old are you?
I'm 40.
Okay. I'm 41. 40's young. That's
very.
I heard that, Dr. Fawzi. Hey, everything is relative. Becky, do you get the sense that, some people in our age group or even younger view, not that they feel invincible, but have a different sort of mindset than maybe our parents' generation?
Yes, I think that's probably fair.
And probably appropriately so, I guess. So before we let you go, Becky, what's next for you then? What have you been told to expect, and what's sort of the end of your participation going to look like?
I'll be keeping a diary, like Dr. Fawzi mentioned, tracking my symptoms for the next week. I go back in next week for a checkup. They typically draw blood and check, make sure I haven't had any adverse side effects. And then I go back another week after that. And then after that, I believe it's a 1 month follow-up, a 6 month follow-up, and then I forget if it's a 1 year or a 2 year follow-up. So they'll keep track of me for up to 2 years.
Okay. And Dr. Fawzi, the participants like Becky Timmons, what specifically are researchers looking for?
Well, it really depends on the phase of vaccine trial that you mean, who we're recruiting or what we're looking for.
Once you've got a Becky Timmons in this trial, you know, she's coming in. But what exactly, I mean, I guess you're, look, I'm totally ignorant on this process. My assumption is you're just wondering if she gets sick or not. I mean, gets
the other thing, Becky, that you're going to be doing is if you were to get sick at all with any symptoms that could be coronavirus, we will be evaluating and testing for that. So over this next year or so, she will, even though she won't be coming in to see us, she'll be under some surveillance that, if she gets sick, she'll do some self-swabbing and we'll test her for coronavirus. So, you know, we want to know with our healthy volunteers, you know, do they develop a good immune response? And there's different kinds of immune response. There's, plain old antibody, and then there's really great antibody that binds to the virus and actually inactivates it, and we call that neutralizing antibody. So that's what we're looking at. We're going to be looking at whether that antibody response is what we call durable. Does it last? So she'll be having some additional blood samples, as she noted, 6 months and a year, to see if the antibody levels, even if they're really great for a month after you get it, you know, how long do they circulate? So things of that nature.
Yeah, and Dr. Falzy, I'm glad you bring this up because we saw headlines in just the last 7 days, and boy, if I've learned anything about understanding infectious disease in the last 3 months, it's be very careful, check a lot of sources, check how big of a sample is coming out.
Yeah.
But some of the headlines in the last 7 days have been discouraging. They've indicated that antibody levels decline pretty rapidly in some patients who've been monitored. I don't know how wide of a study that is or how definitive that is. Do you know anything about that?
Well, I think we're just learning about this infection, but we do know something about other seasonal respiratory viruses, and we know about seasonal coronaviruses. And so while antibody levels peak, shortly after you're infected, in a lot of other diseases, they also sort of gradually drift down. But your body remembers. It has memory. And so should you come in contact with that virus again, you would have a very rapid immune response. And so generally speaking, you might get an infection again, but you have partial immunity, so you would not become severely ill. And in that way, you know, the hope with coronavirus is that people that have recovered, it's not to say, oh, you'd never get this again, but you wouldn't end up on a ventilator or possibly dying of it. You would just get, you know, either a cold or a bad bronchitis or, you know, one of the more seasonal viruses. But everybody, I think, they scare people because they constantly are saying, we don't know. And you have to say that because it's true. This is a new virus. We don't have years of experience. But I personally am hopeful that there will be immunity. It will not be lifelong, but it will be partial, and that we will be relatively protected from severe disease.
All right, Becky, before we let you go, do you have any other questions? Are there big questions on your mind, either on a daily basis or looking forward, or do you feel like you've got your head around what you need to be doing in this trial?
No, I don't have any questions. I think what I'm hoping right now is that they get the volunteers that they needed for the further phases of the trial.
Absolutely.
It sounds like those are much bigger numbers.
Absolutely. Becky, thanks for sharing your experience as one of 40 local people who is participating in this vaccine trial. Thanks for joining us, and good luck to you. And yes, thank you for what you're doing.
Well, thank you.
That's Becky Timmons. So, Dr. Branch, are we speaking of, as Becky mentions, she's hoping that you get more people involved and this thing can move forward. Are we moving towards a phase two with this anytime soon?
Well, we are moving towards phase two with Pfizer, and I think we're also planning on starting phase three trials for 1 to 2 candidate vaccines here in Rochester in August and September. So, yes, we're moving into the next phases for sure.
And Dr. Branch, given your increasing optimism about the speed of vaccine development, we know that there's, more than 80 or more than 100 efforts underway around the world in different countries trying to create a vaccine. And so when we hear that this one is just phase one, again, this is me being ignorant of the process, I might be tempted to think, well, then they're behind what everybody else is doing. Mm-hmm. And number one, I mean, I don't know how true that is, because what probably matters more is effectiveness. I mean, you could be at stage two or stage three, but what's it matter if ultimately you're going to hit a dead end? How do you feel that this one is stacking up to what you understand is happening in other places around the world?
I don't actually think it's that far behind. I think that, you know, we've heard things in the news about the Moderna study, about the study coming out of the University of Oxford, which is now partnered with AstraZeneca. There are several other large pharma companies that have partnered with the United States and with other countries to sort of get these trials underway. Under Operation Warp Speed, in sort of conjunction with the NIH and with BARDA, some of these large pharmaceutical companies are being funded through the NIH and through BARDA to sort of fast-track this whole thing. And all of them are sort of in the phase one phase, at the end of phase one, moving into phase two, towards the end of phase two. So I would say Pfizer and some of these others, they're probably all within a month to 2 months of each other of completing their phase two and maybe moving into phase three. So I think this fall will be really exciting, because we'll have several candidates, possibly even including Pfizer, in phase three trials. And so it's really just kind of a race to see who gets there first, knowing that probably by early next year, if more than one is successful, we might have more than one successful, effective vaccines to distribute, not just here in the United States, but hopefully around the world.
All right. And listeners, if you are feeling inspired by Becky Timmons, who was just with us, who's one of the participants in phase one of this vaccine trial, and you're interested in participating in future phases, I will direct you to this website. It's covidresearch.urmc.edu. I'll do it again. covidresearch.urmc.edu for more information. If you're interested in volunteering, it should be all there. Dr. Falzi, any idea what exactly you're looking for future phases?
Well, as we move and expand into the phases, the criteria, the stringent criteria we have in phase one loosen up. So people with stable medical conditions are welcome. As we move into phase three, that's where you're trying to figure out whether it's truly effective. We actually are looking for people who, by circumstance or occupation, may be at higher than average risk for actually becoming infected. So, you know, people that are on the front lines, EMTs, people that work in retail, bus drivers, bartenders, you name it. You know, just people who are out there. You know,
people who work in grocery stores, for example.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's great. And you know, I think we've gotten into such a rhythm with this pandemic that we probably don't say it enough. And I'll just echo it. If you work in a grocery store, if you drive a bus, if you are anywhere that is put consistently in your work, interacting with a high number of people, and that's a lot of jobs, we are grateful. And it continues to be important and, yes, even heroic work, and we are grateful. Thank you for that. And, again, the website if you want to participate in a future vaccine trial. It's covidresearch.urmc.edu. All right, I'm going to get George on the phone in a second. He's talking about therapies. Let me get a couple of quick vaccine questions in. Liz writes to say, please tell St. Becky that she is wonderful, and we are grateful for what she's doing. And then Liz goes on to ask, would you ask your guests to talk about the progress of EIDD2801, which I have heard is being studied at Emory University as a potential treatment, which could be taken orally? I don't know this one. Doctors Branch or Falzi, do you?
I believe that is the medication that is being considered for the NIH consortium. It is an oral medication. Those I can't remember the exact letters and numbers, but that sounds like the promising medication that's being considered for the ACT trial. So it will follow the remdesivir-baricitinib trial.
Okay. Benjamin emails to ask, is there a trial phase where individuals with blood cancers can participate?
At this time, if you have a blood cancer that for which you are undergoing treatment, then you likely wouldn't be eligible to participate in a vaccine trial. However, if you're in remission, you have been for at least a year, it's certainly something that could be considered. And so we would certainly welcome having that discussion with you and seeing if you are eligible.
Benjamin's a semi-frequent emailer, going through a lot. Much love to you, Benjamin. Good luck. Let me get George and Geneseo on the phone. Go ahead, George.
I want to follow up. Greetings, all. I want to follow up on reports I heard earlier in the year. One is about vitamin D levels and recovery, and the other is about dexamethasone interacting with this remdesivir. Thank you so much.
Okay. Who wants to take that one? Go ahead.
How about I'll do vitamin D and you can talk about dexamethasone,
sure.
Angela. So vitamin D, I don't think there's any definitive research with COVID in particular. It has been suggested as a potential effect, if people are very vitamin D deficient for a number of respiratory viruses. It does have immune modulating effects. So it's a good question. I'm sorry I don't have any answers for you at the moment.
Okay, and Dr. Branch?
So dexamethasone, I'm glad you brought up the question. Dexamethasone is a steroid that has been in use to treat all sorts of respiratory illnesses and neurological illnesses for decades. It's very good in treating sort of out-of-control inflammation, causing inflammation of the airways and for airways to close down and to help people who need to breathe better. So there's recently been a large trial coming out of the UK called the Recovery Trial, which is looking at dexamethasone as treatment for patients with COVID-19. And what they found was that it seems to potentially decrease the risk of mortality, particularly for patients who are very severely ill and on the ventilator. From a scientific standpoint, it makes sense because steroids and dexamethasone is one of them, are a potent anti-inflammatory drug. And so it could be acting against that sort of deranged, overexpressed inflammation that we're seeing in COVID-19 patients. Steroids sort of have many side effects as well, and it also impacts more than just inflammation. It has sort of a more broad effect on the immune response. So traditionally, we don't always like to give steroids in an infection because some parts of the immune response is actually very helpful. But I think that potentially the combination of dexamethasone or a steroid like that with an antiviral that's targeting the virus itself, that could be a very beneficial combination, particularly in some of these most severely ill patients.
All right. Larry emails to say, do we know anything about challenge trials? That came up a few months ago. I haven't heard anything. So, again, I'll just say briefly, a challenge trial, as I understand it, is where participants in a vaccine trial are given a possible vaccine and then are intentionally introduced to the virus to be challenged with it to see if the vaccine can ward it off. And this is obviously something that's safer to do if there is a known treatment for a disease. And in the case of COVID-19, there isn't. And so there are some questions on the ethics side of intentionally challenging patients with this coronavirus. Dr. Branch, are we seeing anything in the way of challenge trials?
Not yet. And, I sort of have a physician's discomfort with the idea of that and some ethical concerns about challenging people with a potentially fatal infection, even if we do have treatment, which, as we talked about, isn't necessarily a magic bullet in that it's a cure-all. So I think that with the number of cases and hotspots that we're seeing cropping up all across the country, that's likely to be something that we unfortunately continue to face for several more months. I don't think that there's necessarily any interest in challenge trials enough. I think we have enough disease in the United States that we can sort of pick and choose where we're going to do these efficacy studies in a way that actually will give us the answers we're looking for.
All right, Dr. Falzy, I'm going to conclude here with a question you may sort of loathe, but I'll ask you anyway, because you've been so patient with us. I'm going to ask you, as we look at the horizon, there's so much unknown, and we're learning a lot about a brand new disease. I frankly think the medical community has been remarkable about how they're communicating, how they're treating the lives that are being saved. But we don't know where this ends up. Give me your brief sense in the 90 seconds about sort of the best case, worst case as we look at treatments and vaccine.
I think the best case scenario is that within the next year, we have multiple vaccines that are effective so all the manufacturers can scale up and we can convince the population that this is good and we'll vaccinate and things will relatively calm down. Worst case scenario, I think, is that none of the vaccine candidates work and that we're left with relying on herd immunity, but that means a lot of people would be passing away.
Mm. And Dr. Branch, when Dr. Falzy, as we wrap up here, talks about scaling up here, it's important, I think, for myself to always keep in mind, the day that we can announce this vaccine works, we've got enough evidence, doesn't mean that we have enough to distribute to a large amount of the population. What's the best case timeline for getting it to a lot of people?
One vaccine is not going to be sufficient because we don't have to just vaccinate everyone here. We have to vaccinate everyone in the world, as many people in the world as we can. So one vaccine will definitely not be enough. Even if we had one vaccine that makes it to the finish line, we won't have enough vaccine to vaccinate everyone in the United States. So we actually need multiple candidates that sort of all reach that end goal roughly around the same time. And I think that's why you're seeing so many different, 100-plus different mm-hmm. candidates that are kind of moving forward. And that's really what we need. We needed all of those, and we need them fast.
By the way, some listeners are interested to know if they want to participate in future vaccine trials. Is there a phone number? Is there a phone number to call, Dr.
Yes,
Branch and Falzy?
273-3990.
Do it again one more time.
273-3990.
Listeners, 585-273-3990. Or otherwise, jump on covidresearch.urmc.edu. Our thanks to Drs. Falzy and Branch for the work you're doing, for the impact on this community, and for the expertise. We know we ask a lot of your time. We hope to talk to you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wonderful conversation. Just amazing what's happening, isn't it? More connections coming up next.